Blog Talk Radio.
All right. Thanks so much for joining us today on We Hear You, where we find the humanity in the headlines. I am your host, Atiba Buchanan, and joining me today is, of course, Mr. David Seaton.
How's everyone doing? Happy Easter.
Absolutely. And we have a special guest co-host today, Miss Terry Connor. How are you, Miss Terry?
Hello. How are you, Atiba and David? Thank you so much for having me today.
We thank you for joining us. Our other co-host, Rashida Graham Washington, is out today. She will be joining us again next week. So she will be back. But in light of her absence, we asked Miss Terry Connor. She is a good friend of mine, and I wanted her to come on and get to know our audience and for my audience to get to know her as well. Terry, why don't you go ahead and tell our listeners, if they're not familiar with you, a little bit about your background and how they can follow you.
Hi, my name is Terry Connor. As Atiba said, I go by the tagline of Terry D, and you can find me on any social media outlet at IamTerryD.com. That would be on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. Also, I guest co-host on WVON a couple times a month with Art Chat Daddy Sims. We talk all things relationships. I am a relationship coach. I am an entrepreneur, a speaker, and a media personality. Mostly I talk about building healthy and sustainable relationships, and not just between men and women, but just relationships amongst people, period. So if it's a professional relationship or in your job, I talk all things relationships. So I guess co-host, I blog, and I hold conversation parties. And pretty much that's it. And I do a lot of guest co-hosting on a lot of different radio shows. I just recently did one down in Memphis, and that was pretty awesome, too, when we talked about politics. So that's who I am, Terry D, and you can follow me, as I said, on anything, IamTerryD.com.
Absolutely. I was hoping to be able to really get into something, you know, that's in your purview. I know you are a relationship person. I didn't see anything this week that really stuck out, though, that would allow us to, you know, allow you to, you know, shine in your area, so to speak. But I also know that you're more than capable of talking about a slew of topics. So that's why we definitely have you on today. And let's get to the heart of the matter. We want to talk Brussels, and not just Brussels, but terrorism in general. Now, one thing, again, our tagline on the show is finding the humanity in the headlines, and that's what, you know, that's what we do. So first off, our hearts and prayers are with the people of Belgium, certainly in Brussels, and which is the capital of Belgium. I didn't know that until this. And we definitely would like to see justice performed in this, and that the individuals that have perpetrated this be brought to justice as well. You know, so with that said, what David always asks the top of the show, when you saw the bombings take place in Brussels, what were your initial thoughts?
My initial thoughts were, I think, like what most people thought, here we go again. Mm-hmm. We have another attack on one of our NATO allies in Europe, where you have an unnamed bomber, or lone wolf, or an extension of ISIS, or Al-Qaeda, or Daesh, or whatever you want to call them. And we have another group of individuals who were just going about their daily lives and got killed by someone who was espousing a radical ideology, or at least practicing a radical ideology. I think the one thing that we're missing from really analyzing this situation, and you and I talked about it before the show, Atiba, we keep missing the why.
Yeah, we're definitely going to bring that up.
Yeah, we've got the who, the what, the when, the where, but we keep ignoring the why. And until we get to the why, we're never really going to find a solution to trying to stem the tide of what the right likes to call radical Islamic jihad, what we just call, you know, just radical
extremism,
whether it's Islamic or Christian or whatever it is. Understanding the why is going to be the only way we're going to find a solution to the issue.
So let's talk about then the things that have to precede the why. Let's talk about some of the facts. This event happened Tuesday, March 22nd. It was in Brussels, again, which is the capital of Belgium. And there were two coordinated attacks. At the Brussels airport, there was a suicide bomber that killed 10 people. And at a subway station, that killed 20 people, and there were over 230 injured. There were two Americans killed that we were able to confirm, Justin Schultz, and age 30, and his wife, Stephanie Schultz, age 29. Unfortunately, they were killed at the airport, actually while dropping someone off at the airport.
Mm-hmm.
The person that they were dropping off apparently was not injured. Who coordinated the attacks? Right now, the authorities are looking for two brothers, Khalid and Brahim El-Bakri, are suspected of carrying out suicide bomb attacks at the Brussels airport on Tuesday. We got some other things we're going to talk about, too, as well, because this seems to be a trend. At Charlie Hebdo, Boston Marathon, and now Brussels, these are all attacks that appear to be perpetrated by siblings. So, we've got to talk about that as well. So, Terry, let me ask you as well, what were your initial thoughts upon hearing the attacks?
My initial thoughts definitely piggyback on both your thoughts and if David said, you know, you're like these extremists and you're trying to figure out the why. The why makes your chest just fall to your stomach because I know that, you know, you have these suicide bombers. But you can't, I mean, I guess if you're not in that state of mind, you definitely cannot identify with them. I guess the other thing is, it's like, what do we do? You know, like, what do we do to help? What do we do to try and curtail this or stop it altogether? I'm not sure that we can because we can't identify the why. And right. As I woke to this news, I was almost speechless. Like,
yeah.
Here we go once again with unanswered, you know, just we have all these, you know, questions looming in the air and in our hearts and our minds as we pray for them, but not knowing, and I can't imagine even being in their situation, why do they continue to do that and what are they looking for? What, you know, I know some are suicide bombers, but you still have one, I think they have an arrest. At one point they said they had six people arrested. I think some they let go. But what is it that we can do? You know, what are you looking for? What is the why from them? Not just we want to know why, but what are they looking for? You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Well, joining us right now, we have someone who is more than qualified to help us answer some of these questions, some of the many questions that we have. On the line now is Miss Jennifer Lowenstein. How are you, ma'am?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
Oh, we are excellent. Thank you so much for joining us today on We Hear You, where we find the humanity in the headlines. If you could go ahead, before we get started with any questions, Ms. Lowenstein, I'd just like you to take a second to tell our listeners a little bit about yourself.
Well, I was a faculty associate at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and now I am a faculty associate at Penn State University. So I've gone through a big transition in the past year. I teach modern Middle Eastern history and politics, and I've lived in the Middle East on a number of occasions. I've been to Egypt, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, Israel, and Palestine. I lived in Lebanon, and I lived in the Gaza Strip and East Jerusalem. So I feel I know the place fairly well. I've also read as much as I can and followed the media. So a lot of questions that are out there, I'm trying to answer for friends in a way that they can understand.
Absolutely. So let me ask you then, off top, when you initially saw the coverage coming out of the out of Belgium, what were your thoughts about that?
Well, my emotional response was, oh, God, not another one, because these are horrible attacks. And, you know, I think it would be strange for anyone to not feel that way. I mean, I would be surprised by anyone saying, oh, well, they deserved it. You know, that's kind of bizarre to me. But I know people who have said that kind of thing.
Oh, wow.
My emotional thoughts, so to speak, are a lot different than my intellectual thoughts or mental thoughts, which are if only people understood why this is happening, then we could take some steps to prevent it from happening even more. I don't think most people even connect the bombings in Paris and Brussels, for example, to U.S. and Western European policies in the Middle East for the last century. I don't think people make that connection. They see this as an aggressive and offensive attack on innocent civilians. And it's not that simple.
And that's an interesting point you bring up, Jennifer. This is David Seaton, by the way, and thank you for being on the show today. I want you to expound on that if you can, because as I see this, and when we get into the why, this really, to your point, you said this is not defense, or this is not offensive, this is defensive. We have for the most part, as a United States and as a European policy globally, we have, through imperialism, to kind of almost excise the Middle East for the purposes of acquiring energy. We are staying in that part of the world where the indigenous people don't want us there, and it's always kind of convenient for the United States and or for European powers to categorize the response from other people as guerrilla warfare, because that's just convenient. But really, that's the only way they have to respond. They don't have a standing navy or a fleet of drones, or you know, they can't fight us in a conventional manner the way that we conduct our military. So really, that's the only response that they have, isn't it?
Yeah, and I want to just go back to one thing. I don't see this as a defensive response, because it's you know, they're not defending themselves. I see it as a reaction to 100 years of continual bombardment, oppression, invasion, colonization, occupation of the Middle East by Britain, France, and the United States. When you know, it's pretty hard to expect any people to sit back and take being beaten for decades and decades without finally turning around and hitting back. And that's what's happening. And what's really tragic is that the people who are most often the direct victims of all of this are civilians, people who haven't made the policies, people who haven't done anything politically or militarily to harm anyone over in the Middle East. And yet when radical Islamic jihadists, who are in fact partly the creation of U.S. policies, when they hit back, they're hitting back out of, it is a reaction, it's an angry, angry reaction, but they're also hitting people who are innocent. And I think there's a message in that. I think they're saying, if you're going to bomb us, if you're going to carry out airstrikes day after day after day and kill as many people as you do, most of whom are civilians, then we're not going to care about your civilians either. In other words, you know, if you can do it to us, we can do it right back to you, and see how it hurts. There's a fire blazing out of control in the Middle East that we helped set. And what we're trying to do now is to put that fire out with more fire. It doesn't work that way.
Mm. That's a great, great analogy. I think my other co-host, Ms. Terry Conner, may have a question for you.
Sure.
I do. I know, so I heard your feedback and you're saying about the invasion. So do you think that if we from the United States did not go over it, should we not be helping? Should we not, you know, do they feel like us helping, are we invading them and invading their country? Do you think they're feeling that way?
Excuse me. Well, I think we have to clarify what time frame we're talking about. In the most recent sense, in the most recent way I can explain this, is that in 2003, the United States went to war illegally against Iraq. The only people, the only country that supported us at that time was Britain. We invaded Iraq. We got rid of Saddam Hussein. That was allegedly one of our primary motivations, was to get rid of Saddam Hussein and weapons of mass destruction, which in fact never existed or didn't exist when we invaded then and hadn't for quite a long time. We invaded, got rid of Saddam Hussein, and we didn't go home and say, okay, now you guys can have a free election, free and fair election. We didn't stay to help them organize it. On the contrary, what we did was we occupied Iraq. We stayed there, and we put the people of Iraq under U.S. control, and nobody wants that. No American that I can think of would want another country to invade us and then stay here and say, you're under our control now. When we did that, what we did was we opened the gates to resistance. The United States, it's a very complicated history, but it's not so complicated that people can't understand it. The people who were in power under Saddam Hussein were primarily Sunni Muslims. When the Americans went in, they wanted not only to get rid of Saddam Hussein, but the entire administration, the entire Ba'ath party that he represented. So what we did effectively was to alienate the Sunni Muslim community in Iraq. It's no surprise now that ISIS, the people who make up ISIS, are radicalized Sunni Muslim jihadists who have taken their cues from countries like Saudi Arabia, where the state religion is a very extremist, puritanical version of Islam. And this is what has developed. ISIS came right out of Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda, of course, was an offshoot of, you know, going back to 1979 when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan. The U.S. response was to arm Afghans and what were called the Arab Afghans, Arabs primarily from Saudi Arabia, to fight the Soviet Union. And we thought, you know, well, what difference does it make if we give a bunch of guns and rocket shoulder-fired missiles to a bunch of Arabs and Afghans to help us fight the Soviet Union? They're small, weak, and, you know, powerless, and the Soviet Union is a big superpower, so we're going to do anything we can to get them out. Well, those same people that we armed and trained to fight the Soviet Union turned around after that, after the USSR left Afghanistan, and basically pointed their arms at us and said, the Soviet Union has occupied us, and we didn't want to be occupied by them, and now you're coming in to do the very same thing. And it wasn't just Afghanistan. It's also the Israeli occupation of Palestine. It's also the United States' need to control Middle Eastern resources, primarily oil and natural gas. It's even beyond that. It's beyond economic. It's strategic. The Middle East is a crossroads between Europe and the what used to be called the East Indies. India, it's a trade route and a military route. It's a way of getting battleships and military equipment across the continent in a swifter way. There are lots of reasons why we have been in the Middle East for so many decades, we meaning the U.S. and the U.K. primarily. After the 2003 invasion and occupation of Iraq, resistance to the American grew exponentially year after year after year. And instead of making policies that would mitigate or, you know, push down this resistance to make people less angry at us, we did the opposite. We armed and trained Shia Muslims who then were attacking Sunnis, and the Sunnis were attacking the Shia, and we were alienating both groups at the same time and trying to put somebody in power, an Iraqi in power, who is basically our puppet. And the people of Iraq... Yes, go ahead.
So when you say we, could you be more specific? Are you talking about the Bush administration, the Obama administration, or a combination?
Yeah, well, both. I mean, U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East has been very monolithic. I mean, almost constant since the end of the Second World War. Our strategic and economic, political interests in the Middle East have not shifted in any significant way since 1945. And so we can't just point our finger at Bush or Obama. We can go back, you know, a few decades and say, well, this just hasn't changed. We still want to control that region.
And when you go back that far, you're going back to 1953 when we assassinated the Shah and tried to install our own person so that we could get access to the oil of Saudi Arabia.
Well, no, it's in 1953 the United States and the UK conspired to overthrow the president, the democratically elected president of Iran, Mohammad Mossadegh. And they conspired to do this because Mossadegh nationalized the Iranian oil companies and Iranian oil. We didn't want them to nationalize it because that meant that our companies would lose out on the profits, on the lion's share of the profits. So what we decided to do, we, the U.S. and the U.K. governments, along with MI6 and the CIA, our intelligence organizations, went in and we manufactured a coup that got rid of Mohammad Mossadegh, who was very popular and, as I said, democratically elected, and we installed Shah Reza Pahlavi, who was the Shah of Iran for 20 years, more than that. He was the Shah of Iran from 1953 until 1979, that borderline years. And during that time, our control of Iran was fairly nefarious. It's hard to come up with a good word. We were supporting the Shah of Iran, who had one of the most oppressive regimes in the Middle East at the time. It had an abysmal human rights record. People who opposed the regime were being tortured in prison, executed in prison, or chased out of the country. Opposition to any of the Shah's policies or reforms meant, you know, your life was in danger. It's not just, you know, it's not a place where you could voice your opposition and then get away with it. That's not possible. And we can talk about, well, that was Iran, that was their human rights record, but it was the Americans who put the Shah in power and never said to him, you've got to be better, you can't torture your opponents, and you can't. Right. As a matter of fact, and I think this is very important, the Iranian SAVAK, S-A-V-A-K, it was the equivalent of the CIA, was created by the CIA and the Israeli Mossad. And it was one of the most vicious and notoriously cruel secret police organizations in the Middle East. That was our creation. So we can't shake our fingers at Iran at that time and say, oh, you have a bad human rights record.
Right.
And it's, you know, you have to see this in a broad picture. Saudi Arabia has an even worse human rights record than Iran, and Saudi Arabia beheaded more people in the past year than ISIS did. Saudi Arabia is one of the United States' two most important allies in the Middle East, and I don't hear anyone in the Obama administration standing up in public and saying the Saudi human rights record is so horrible that to remain its ally is beyond, way beyond unethical or immoral. There's something terribly wrong with this. The same is true of Israel, by the way. We don't do anything to stop the wholesale torture and ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians.
That's a great point that you bring up. What I'd like to do, and I love the way that you brought us, you know, obviously from 1953 forward, amazing commentary. So with that said, my question is this. We've had all types of bombings over the past, really this month, which really isn't all that new. But this particular bombing obviously held a media cycle for the almost the better part of a week. Why
yes.
is it? And we even had a bombing today in Pakistan that killed 60 people.
Horrible, yes.
And I think they were targeting Christians in light of Easter is what they're suspecting
right.
at this time. But
yes,
with that said, why is it that we don't hear more about other bombings in other areas?
Well, there
world.
Are two things. There are two things that I would mention. First of all, it is natural for Westerners to identify more with Westerners. That doesn't surprise me. On the one hand, on the other hand, it's no secret to anyone who has his or her eyes open that we have a terribly racist government. And we have had racist administrations, including the Obama administration, by the way, insofar as its policies overseas are concerned. We don't really care about Iraqis and Afghans and Pakistanis. We care about white Europeans. And, for example, what happened in Brussels and what happened in the fall in Paris, that's happening every day in Iraq. Every single day, Iraqis are being attacked by ISIS or another group similar to it. Every
well, it's been
single
said that
95%
day. Of, it's been said that 95% of people that suffer from terrorism are Muslims themselves, correct?
Absolutely, and that's another thing that most people don't understand. I have a friend who was sort of self-righteously shaking her fist and saying, these people are killing Christians. You know, what kind of, you know, who would ever support Muslims? And I really had to sit her down, not in a way where I'm scolding her, because I want her to learn, and say, look, the people you're talking about, in this case ISIS, have killed, you know, 500 times more Muslims than they have Christians. Secondly, most Muslims will say straight out that ISIS does not represent Islam. It's a kind of extremist cult that uses the trappings of Islam, language, the Quran, whatever, to carry out acts that no Muslim would ever sanction, no true Muslim would ever sanction them. And, you know, until people understand that, we're going to continue to have Islamophobic leaders in this country, not only leaders, but we're going to have an Islamophobic and an anti-Arab public. You know, this is all over the media. These are Muslim terrorists who are carrying out these attacks. It's become a political tool.
Right. Let me ask you this, and I don't want to hear your opinion, having lived in that part of the world. If the United States and our European allies became energy independent and we withdrew from the Middle East, do you think that Islamic jihadism or Islamic extremism would abate?
It would. I don't think we would see it abate overnight. One reason is because There have always been sectarian conflicts between the Sunni and Shia Muslims, for example, like there were between Catholics and Protestants. But at the time that we invaded Iraq, Sunnis and Shia were living in the same neighborhoods, going to the same schools, intermarrying, sharing, you know, having parties together. It was not what we're seeing today, where Sunnis and Shia have two groups of Muslims are literally slaughtering each other. That situation, the sectarian strife that is currently going on, is something that the United States is directly responsible for, along with Saudi Arabia, which funds and arms ISIS, not today, but it did when ISIS, with Al-Qaeda, Saudi Arabia and many people in Saudi Arabia, private citizens, are funding these groups because they represent the kind of extremist Islam that is the state religion of Saudi Arabia. I know this is a lot of information, but what I'm saying is that if the United States and Britain and France were to pull out of the Middle East overnight, there conflict wouldn't cease. But that conflict is, to a great extent, our responsibility, and we have an obligation, in my view, to help stop, to help keep it from spreading even further. I don't think sectarian strife is going to go away if the Americans leave the Middle East. It's like I said before, we set that fire. Putting it out requires a lot of things, not more fire. And the only way the United States, Britain, and France, and many other Western European countries seem to think they can solve their problems is militarily. And if we think that way, we're not going to solve anything. We're going to make things worse. We can't solve the crises of the Middle East using military power. It won't work.
Well, we absolutely appreciate the information today. I'm sure our listeners do as well. And we're not letting you go, but I just wanted to let you know that the information you're giving is very valuable, because in the mainstream media, it's hard to have this kind of detailed, nuanced conversation and understanding.
It's almost impossible.
Right.
People don't want to accept that we have such a critical role in having paved the way for the birth of ISIS.
Absolutely.
Nobody ever asks those questions. It absolutely boggles the mind.
Well, that's one thing I've always said, is that, you know, American people don't do well with nuance. We do much better with broad generalizations, sweeping generalizations, and we definitely have to get out of that habit. With that said, bringing it back to the U.S., what is your opinion of the presidential candidate's response to the attack in Brussels?
Well, I think all of them are wrong. I mean, what can I say? First of all, none of them are admitting our responsibility in setting this fire. Secondly, all of them have suggested military responses. I think Bernie Sanders is the only candidate who said, look, at the very least, we need an Arab coalition, a united Arab front to help solve this problem, not more Westerners going in and telling them what to do, which is unbelievably patronizing. So Sanders has some sense. The other three are completely avoiding the issues. They changed the debate to what's going to happen to our civil liberties? We have to step up security. We can't go to an airport without practically donating your blood, you know, for a sample. It's getting crazier and crazier and crazier, and none of that's necessary. If we could, and it's not simple, but over time, realize that the way to stop these kinds of policies here in our own country, the way to stop people having to go through these outrageous security checks at airports and other places isn't to step up security even more. It's to stop doing what we're doing in the Middle East, to stop contributing to the violence there that is occurring every day. As I said, we went in and smashed Iraq, all right? It's like somebody took a baseball bat to to a glass window or a shop with glass windows and smashed it to pieces. And now we're saying, you know, look at those people. They have broken windows and it's getting worse and worse and the building is starting to fall apart. And, You know, they're not rebuilding it. They're, you know, destroying it even further. I mean, what hypocrisy! I mean, we don't have to give up. We don't have to give up our civil liberties. What we have to do is give up our thinking that everything is going to be solved by violence. And we also have to stop excusing the ignorance of Americans. The media in our country is terrible. All it does, in my view, is to encourage some of the most ugly stereotypes and, you know, racist views. But Americans can go find out information from a huge number of sources. And I remember once when I was living in Beirut, talking to a doctor who is very angry at the United States and its policies, especially toward the Palestinians. And he said to me one day, "You know, Jennifer, it's not the ignorance, it's not that Americans are ignorant. Of course they're ignorant. That's not what bothers me. It's not the ignorance that bothers me. It's that people are ignorant and they don't care that they don't know. Not only do they not know what's going on, but they don't care that they don't know what's going on. They're not saying, well, gee, maybe I should go find out. Maybe I should read. Maybe I should talk to a number of different people from different backgrounds. What's wrong with us?
Jennifer.
Yes.
So I know this is Terry Connor, and
yes.
I definitely appreciate all the background that you've given us. I'm like, oh, wow, I'm typing and writing and figuring out. I mean, I've done a lot of background information on it, and I know that you're speaking of the ignorance of,
mm-hmm.
you know, Americans that you're saying. I think some of it is ignorance in the sense of, like you're saying, they don't know, but they don't want to know. And we go back and we talk about the responses from the presidential candidates and Cruz and Trump. Now, what is your response? I'll say I think that a lot of people have criticized even President Obama's response, and I don't think that all of his response was terrible in what he did. You may not agree with me,
mm-hmm.
but in some sense, you can't add fuel to the fire, you know.
No,
I
agree
you
with you. In fact,
I think that I
was too sweeping in my criticism, probably because of my own frustration. I think John Kerry, for example, and Barack Obama both know that something else has to be done. I think both of them are aware that, you know, you'd have to be pretty dense to be the President of the United States or the Secretary of State and not have some understanding that we have a big role to play in all of this. I think one of the problems is that we have schools and media and other civil institutions where people are being indoctrinated with false ideas, with, I believe, very negative and racist stereotypes. Now, that's not fair to everyone because I've been in public schools and private schools where there is a big effort to try to combat a lot of these stereotypes, but I don't think we're doing it strongly enough. I think we need to educate our citizens better. And I also think that people like Kerry and Obama, you know, they are individuals, and they're also symbols of an office. I always wonder what Barack Obama really thinks about some of this, some of these events as a private person, and what he is actually capable of doing in the office of the president. I mean, he's not autonomous. He is controlled by all kinds of corporate influences, you know, lobby organizations, a Republican Senate in his case, a Republican Congress. You know, in many ways, he cannot act in a way. I don't know how he would act if he didn't have any.
That.
You know,
I agree with that also, but I also think that you know, and of late, he's been very aggressive in how, you know, in his conversations and
right.
the dialogue that he shared. He's been very aggressive in how he feels about it. I think people think maybe his lack, you know, approach, but he still is very aggressive in
yeah.
how he, you know, conveys his feelings. I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say we have to bear in mind, too, we just had a senior ISIS leader killed as well
right.
by the
exactly.
Well, I mean, you know, again, I think I'm often reminded of the saying that actions speak louder than words. Many of our politicians, many people in the media, for all I've said, there are people who, you know, their intentions are good and they say the right things, but then we have to look at what our actual policies are. And here's an example. We've heard Donald Trump and Ted Cruz make some terrible statements about immigration. We have done virtually nothing to help the hundreds of thousands, you know, millions of migrants fleeing Syria and Iraq. We're doing nothing. Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, a number of other politicians talk about Donald Trump and Ted Cruz as being these hideous, horrible people for saying we need to build a wall, we need to deport all of these illegal immigrants. Heck, we need to deport all, you know, all the Latino population. Trump is talking about never letting Muslims into the country to begin with. I mean, these are all terrible things that to say in a country that's supposed to be to represent the exact opposite. And so when Obama and Clinton oppose that, you would expect to find policies that are consistent with that. Instead, if you look at the record of immigration, for example, under Obama or under Bush, what you're going to find is pretty much what Donald Trump is advocating, which is that we're getting a bare trickle of migrants. Germany is opening its doors to 800,000 Syrian refugees a year. And Germany is not one of the countries that started it or created or paved the way for the crises over there. The Americans, we can afford in space, in sheer land territory, in terms of economy, in our economy, in so many ways, to let people in this country, that it is a crime we're not taking in more refugees. People talk about, well, what if some of the refugees turn out to be terrorists? Well, what if some of any people coming in turn out to be criminals? You know, it's crazy, that kind of thinking. You know,
yeah.
What should we ban all criminals from our society? I mean, how do you do that? You don't. It's impossible.
I would completely agree with you. We talked about that. We covered the Syrian refugee crisis on the show, and we definitely were of the mindset that there's definitely more that America can and should do. Let me ask you this, and then we're going to end this segment. Again, trying to get American people to understand the nuance of what needs to be done here, because we're not. I think we can agree that we're just not going to kill ISIS, right? You just can't
no.
kill. That's not going to happen. At some point, there's going to have to be some compromise, some understanding. And how do we get people in a country? Because, again, when you talk about Americans and their understanding of things, you know, they've got YouTube videos of, you know, college campuses today that can't name the vice president. So, you know,
I know. I mean, I teach contemporary
right.
Middle Eastern history every semester, and
exactly.
I'm always appalled. But I want to just qualify that and say it may sound like a contradiction to everything I've said so far, but in fact it isn't. I actually think that most individuals are not bad people, and
mm-hmm.
that if most individuals actually had real facts at their fingertips, you would find out that they too would be appalled at what's happening. They too would say, we need to help these people. But instead, what we have are politicians who use issues like Islamophobia as political tools to get elected or not elected, there are polls that show that, for example, anti-Muslim sentiment doesn't really go up after a bombing such as the one in Brussels. When it goes up is during primary season and during election times, when politicians and advertising campaigns and lobbyists are vying for power, and so they use things like Islamophobia to whip up frenzy and fear and hysteria among the people. And I think that's a very interesting finding. That was a finding by, I'm trying to remember the name of the institute, it's a polling institute for citizens for, I can't remember, I wish I could, I'd give you the name. But it's very interesting. It's a very qualified and credible polling institution that shows that, you know, most Americans are not inclined to hate Muslims until the media and politicians get their hooks into a subject that they can scare people with.
Sure.
Then you see these spikes of hatred, of racism. That's very telling. I think it's because, you know, they're giving Americans the wrong information. Not only are they giving them the wrong information, they're giving it to them on purpose because they're fighting an election battle.
We don't have to end it there. We've had a wealth of information for the last 45 minutes. We could talk about this forever.
Right.
So we really appreciate you coming on today. For our listeners out there who want to find you, once again, just tell them where they can find you online and or where they can find you and follow you.
Well, I'm actually working on that. I have a column that I write for a print magazine, and so far they don't put the writings online, and I'm actually in the process of trying to change that because I write a column every month on the Middle East, but it's not online, and that obviously has to change. In general, people can find my writings at Counterpunch, but as I said, I've written 6 articles in the last 5 months, and none of them are going to show up. People can Google my name and they'll find some older pieces. But in the meantime, people want to get in touch with me, they should just email me directly.
Sure.
My email is amadea311@earthlink.net. And you're welcome to give that email out if somebody calls asking for it. I don't mind being in touch with people. I teach at Penn State. I'm obviously a public person with my information is out there. But I wish there was more dialogue about this in the country. I think there's a desperate need for people to know, and I think by judging from the sizes of my classes alone, there are people really, they want to know, they want to find out. And there's one class at the entire University of Penn State on the modern Middle East, and I just don't get that. People
well, we
really want
so.
Yeah, sorry.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. Oh, no, it's fine. We just want to thank you so much for being on today. I'm sure that our listeners I know if they're not, I am. I've been completely enlightened by the information you brought on today. And we just thank you so much. We definitely want you to continue to be a friend of the show.
I want to thank you very much for having me and for letting me talk, because I usually get on for 10 minutes and you can't say anything in 10 minutes. So
exactly.
Thank you very much.
You got it. You got it. It was
great
today.
We will be in touch.
Yes.
Thank you so
stay
much.
In touch.
Thank
it
you
was
so
my
much.
Pleasure.
No.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That was a lot. I mean, we went from 1948
right
all the way through today. but you made a really important point. We've got so many low information voters out
right.
there that the Republicans don't have to, they don't, to your point, they don't have to address nuance. All they have to say is American exceptionalism.
Right. and even the conversation that we had today, many would criticize as being anti-American
mm-hmm.
by simply trying to
yes.
hold America accountable
right.
for its role in where we are today.
Right.
And we're not, you know, again, there, and I can appreciate that line being drawn, but I would certainly attest that we didn't cross it. And two, we have no desire to. You know, we're not sitting here hating America. We love America.
Right.
But at the same time, we recognize we cannot even begin to fix this problem if we are not completely complicit and honest about how the problem began.
Exactly.
And so, if we're not educated on what it is that is going on, or the lack thereof and the ignorance of Americans, then how do we make the right decisions when we are voting? You know what I mean? Like, how do we change policies if we're not making the right decisions?
Right. People really,
you know, we have to be held accountable.
Yes, and people really believe that we can kill this problem of ISIS. It's not going to work that way.
And it was interesting.
Right.
It was interesting to hear her say that when you were talking about terrorism globally, that there is a racist component.
Right.
When we see Westerners, or let's be really specific, when we see white people getting killed,
yeah,
we are aghast. We have to get together and address this issue. But when it happens in Africa or the Middle East,
right,
it's kind of, you know, we barely are aware of it.
And if I'm being honest, I've been guilty of that. Mm-hmm. I see the headlines. There was a bombing and such, and you know, in Turkey and Pakistan or whatever. And I chalk it up as that's how they live. That's another day in the life of.
Mm-hmm.
When it should be so much more than that.
Here's something really, really interesting. I'd love for you to comment on this, Terry. She went all the way back to the Mujahideen in Iran and in Iraq when they were trying to get the Soviet Union out of Afghanistan. And they went over there, the United States went over there, and we supplied them with weapons and RPGs, rocket-propelled grenades and shoulder rockets and blah, blah, blah. Where are they? Okay, that happened 40, 50 years ago. It's 2016. Where are they still getting the bullets? And the rockets, and how are they replenishing the munitions from the weapons that they got 30, 40, 50 years ago? Where is that coming from? It's not coming from, it has to be coming from the West.
Right.
It's almost like we've created the situation and we're further fueling it. And then we look surprised when an act of terrorism is committed.
Yeah. That's what they say is, you know, because when you say that, it reminds me of a lot of things in the U.S. Again, going into the war on drugs in the last few minutes we have left. Let me go to the articles here. So let's see. I'm reading from Equal Justice Initiative. They put out a piece here this week after President Richard Nixon declared a war on drugs in 1971. The number of people incarcerated in American jails escalated from 300,000 to 2.3 million. Half of those in federal prison are incarcerated for drug use or a drug offense, and two-thirds of those in prison for drug offenses are people of color. Disproportionate arrests, conviction, and sentencing rates for drug offenses has escalated in communities of colors in America. What do we think of this bombshell news that this gentleman, let's go to his quote. The gentleman's name, can you say this name, Dave? I can't say it at all.
Ehrlichman.
Yes. I mean, I really can't say this guy's name.
Ehrlichman.
Okay. So the Nixon campaign in 1968 and the Nixon White House after that had two enemies, the anti-war left and black people. You understand what I'm saying? We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or black, but by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and blacks with heroin and then criminalizing those heavily, we could disrupt those communities. We could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did, end quote. Terry, what do you think of that?
This is not the first I've read of that.
Right.
So I'll give you a little history. I know we have very short time. I grew up on the south side of Chicago. And so my parents and my sisters and brothers, these would be family conversations about the war on drugs, about the lies about how the drugs were there. So I'm not shocked by it. I just think that the ignorance of us and how we don't. Now, people tell us right then and there, he told us everything that they have done, but no one is addressing it. No one's talking about it. Everyone's acting as if they don't know. And even if I go back to David's fan talking about the weapons that are getting there, we're supplying them. We are supplying the weapons to them, and then we act real shocked when we see everything happen. But I heard, you know, with the war on drugs, I think.
Well, there's always this element of plausible deniability. And, you know, so even if we talk about, you know, supplying weapons as something that we can plausibly deny, in this case, this is being confirmed. Now, granted, this is a 21-year-old interview, Dave. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts about it taking 21 years to come out?
Well, the actual author, he wrote it in an earlier book. When I read this article, he put out a book in the 90s where he referred to the actual interview that he had with Ehrlichman. But even to your point, Terry, when you talk about it's kind of being an urban legend.
Right.
It's kind of been this thing that we've kind of discussed in our community, but to have confirmation from a sitting or a previously sitting president's administration.
Right.
That's what the bombshell is. And to your point, Terry, nobody's talking about it.
Yeah.
Nobody's talking. It is very disturbing. It's very disturbing that I've heard. I mean, I'll be 50 years old this year, and this is not the first time that I've read that, I've heard it, and it's very disturbing that no one has said. I mean, they literally will tell you how they invade certain neighborhoods and the minorities just in order to take them out of homes, in order to vilify them. And so, you know, that kind of, I don't know, that bothers me in a very deep way that we aren't, even in our current presidential administration, that no one has tried to attack this and figure out how. I mean, I know it's not going to be done overnight, but why aren't we even starting the dialogue at all?
Well, here's the question, and I posted this particular story on my Facebook, on my personal Facebook page, a couple of times. I think I did it 3 times, and each time I posted the picture or I posted this story, I got maybe between 3 and 6 likes. Or 3 and 6 people who actually commented on it. However, if I had put a comment up on my Facebook page about the season premiere of Empire,
yep.
Well, it goes to our priorities, right?
But that's my question. How can a previous president, a member of the administration of a president that is within a generation or two? We're not talking about going back to World War II, or we're not talking about going back to the turn of the century. We're talking about the 60s.
Right.
We're talking about a president whose administration admits to the long-held belief that drugs were purposely put into the black community to destroy it and to give cover to destroying the leaders in that community. And people are not even upset. Like, what has to happen in the black community in 2016 for black people to get upset?
Right.
To get angry and
exactly.
And, right. And
I agree
like
with you,
said,
David and Atiba.
Yeah,
I agree with both of you all. And I think that we, no matter how much they educate us, they're telling us, they're kind of laying it in our hands. Here you go, do something about it. But because that's not our focus, and sometimes I heard a man, and it was a white guy that wrote and said, if you want to hide anything from an African American, put it in a book. We aren't being educated. Even if we are, like you said, you'll get 5 or 6 likes, but we are so focused on surface and just things that don't directly affect our lives. This directly affects us. This could be something that could potentially change the entire dynamic of our culture, but until we actually do something about it, no one else can do it for us.
On that note, I'm going to leave it right there. I try as often as possible, I try to leave things on a call to action, and I think you've just given us that, Terry, with your words. Again, we'd like to thank everyone for listening today. We certainly want to thank our guest, Ms. Jennifer Lowenstein, who gave us tremendous and amazing and accurate information. I want to thank our producer, Mr. Breon Jones, for putting together another amazing show. And we definitely want to thank Ms. Terry Connor for being a co-host with us today, filling in for the humongous shoes of Rashida Graham Washington. We certainly mean that figuratively. and Terry, you did an amazing job today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. I hope we can call on you in the future if we need you.
Absolutely, absolutely. I enjoyed it thoroughly, and I learned a wealth of information.
David, in the last 10 seconds, you want to give us a closing remark?
Let's get out here and vote, everybody. Get out there and vote, because if you don't vote, you can't complain about who's in the office.
Absolutely. Thanks for listening to We Hear You. We'll be back next week. Have a great weekend, everybody. Enjoy and have a wonderful Easter.
You too. Bye-bye.
There we go.